following is a presentation of Learfield IMG College. From the Georgia Southern Sports Network, powered by Learfield IMG College.
Wings up, Eagle Nation! Touchdown, Georgia Southern!
This is Inside Eagle Nation, your all-access look into Eagle athletics.
Taking a look through all the other action in Georgia Southern athletics this past week. A lot of road action. A lot of teams hitting the old I-16 out of town.
Getting on the steel horse and taking us to parts north, south, west, wherever. Can't really go too much farther east.
Now let's return to the Learfield IMG College studios. Here are your hosts, Colin Lacey and Danny Reed.
That's a fact, Jack.
Week one in the books for Georgia Southern football. It wasn't necessarily... There was a lot of that coming up on Saturday. Wasn't necessarily the prettiest thing in the world, but nonetheless, Georgia Southern goes 1-0 last week as they knock off the Campbell Fighting Campbells coming down from Bowie's Creek. We'll dive into that matchup a little bit later on, but as we dive into this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation, Colin Lacey alongside the voice of the Eagles, Danny Reed. We talked about it last week how we weren't really sure that we were going to be able to say week one was in the books, but week one happened. We're on to week two, and we're happy about it.
There were two different feelings of relief on Saturday. Number one, that the game started, and number two, that Georgia Southern hung on to win. It was fun being back. Hadn't done a game in 6 months, thanks to the shutdown. And even though Paulson Stadium was only at 25%, it rained, so it felt like a home game, and there was a delay, so it felt like a baseball game. But to get everybody back, to be able to have football, and to enjoy Georgia Southern's proudest tradition, that is winning football. Yeah, it didn't go the way it probably should have. But would you have rather had the alternative? Would you rather be sitting here 0-1 with a loss to an FCS team and getting ready for a team that won 11 games last year and won Conference USA? No, I think I'll take the 27-26 win. And I think I'll take the fact that so many guys got a lot of experience despite a third of the team being out for a number of reasons, which we will address here in the next few minutes.
Before we dive too deep into this week, take a moment to recognize our fine sponsor, our good folks over at Arcola Septic. Arcola Septic is your premier septic services provider to Bullock, Bryan, and adjoining counties, and a great family-owned business that's run by a pair of Georgia Southern alumni. Make sure to give them a call at 912-318-7939 or visit them online at arcolaseptic.com. For both commercial and residential customers, their more than 10 years of experience can help you out with pumping and servicing your septic system, drain field repairs, new system installation, and all of your septic needs. Remember to follow them on Facebook, Arcola Septic, yesterday's Meals on Wheels. Before we dive too deep into the matchup against the Campbell Fighting Campbells, everything else starts to kick up in Eagle Nation. Again, Olympic sports were pushed back to the initial start of saying September 3rd was the earliest date that competition could happen. But because of schedules being up in the air, we've talked to all three of the head coaches of men's soccer, women's soccer, and volleyball the last couple of weeks. And seeing how much they've had to juggle schedules with different conferences, saying they were either postponing or canceling fall athletics, it's been a nightmare. But nonetheless, the first Olympic sport gets held last night, if you're listening to this on time, on Tuesday, as women's soccer started things off against the Citadel over at Eagle Field in Nerk Park. They will have another matchup later on this week on Thursday up in Conway, South Carolina, as they go to take on the Chanticleers of Coastal Carolina. That's a 6 o'clock kickoff over in Conway. Then obviously on Saturday, Georgia Southern will host Florida Atlantic at Allen E. Paulson Stadium. As far as football is concerned, that a 3:30 kickoff. It'll be on ESPN on the mothership, but you can also listen all across the Georgia Southern Sports Network. We'll dive into the Owls in our final segment of this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation. Men's soccer gets things going on Saturday as well. They will be on the road up in Columbia, South Carolina to take on the Gamecocks of USC. 7 o'clock, the kickoff for Georgia Southern men's soccer as head coach John Murphy will kick off the 2020 season. And then women's soccer will have their third game of the week as they'll be back at Eagle Field in Nerk Park, a 12 noon kickoff on Sunday against Appalachian State. So come to Paulson, see Georgia Southern hopefully take care of business against the Owls at Paulson Stadium, then stay in the camper Saturday night, get up, and some morning, early afternoon soccer for women's soccer.
What time is it on Sunday?
High noon.
Well, I know that a lot of people usually stay on Saturday night anyway, and noon may be a lot to ask for to get them to go to a soccer game.
True. But it's a 3:30 kick, so you get earlier to bed. Well, probably not. Never mind.
You're overthinking.
Yeah, that was wishful thinking.
But we do wish them luck, and we hope that they can get it off to a good start.
Diving into the 27-26 victory for Georgia Southern over Campbell, it's a one-point victory against Campbell. You talked about it earlier. It's not necessarily how anybody kind of envisioned this going, but you look early in the third quarter, it wasn't exactly how anybody envisioned it going either when Georgia Southern's down 20-6.
And considering that they were a 34-point favorite, that score was probably catching a lot of people by surprise. But what won Georgia Southern this game was their culture.
Yeah.
They did not give up, despite being down 33 guys, did not give up the fight. When they got down 20-6, I think that they started playing their best football, and specifically when Shy Wertz came back from his brief, I guess, exercise bike ride after he got the bruise, he ended up being fine. He ends up with 137 of his 155 yards rushing after halftime, 10th career 100-yard game. It was one of the toughest performances I've ever seen from him.
Yeah.
And he's been this team's starting quarterback now for the last 4 years, but I could just feel how much he wanted that game. He started running. He's already fast to begin with, but he just started running with a little bit more vigor. He broke a couple of long runs. I think about the one that happened before his 41-yarder that clinched the game. I thought J.D. King played extremely well. He didn't get a whole lot of pub. He was Georgia Southern to a T. He was blue-collar. He wasn't sexy. He had 18 carries for 74, including a touchdown that tied the game, and it was his block down that near sideline that freed up Shy for the score that eventually won the game. Before the ending of the game, and we'll get to how the final 15 seconds went because it was extremely 2020.
It reminded me a lot of a game you and I saw last year, but we'll get to that when we get to that.
Okay, because I'm curious where you're going with that.
You'll find out.
Okay. Let's address the 33 inactives that Georgia Southern announced at 12:30 on Saturday afternoon. Coach Lunsford has talked about this. Big Frank mentioned it during tailgate. We brought it up numerous times during the game itself. The way that this has to be handled in 2020 in the COVID-19 socially distanced era, if somebody's out, you need to say that they are out. The list was an inactive list, but when people see this, it's automatically the ears go up because, goodness, how are they playing with all these young men affected by COVID? Well, let me stop you right there because not all of them were affected by COVID-19. Yes, a good many of them were contact tracing. Some had contracted the virus, but as we know because of HIPAA, that is not information that is going to be released, at least by Georgia Southern. Some schools over the league and across the country handle that differently, and that's up to them. There was also injuries, suspensions, other team-mandated reasons for why certain guys did not play. And to simply lump all 33 guys under the COVID umbrella, it's not only not smart, it's irresponsible. And to a degree, maybe you get it because every practice has been closed. I mean, we've been there. But even we didn't realize how big the list was going to be. I think we had an idea on some, and Coach talked about this on Monday afternoon about Trevor Vleem's season-ending knee injury. We were actually there for it right before the first scrimmage, but not knowing the severity of it, it couldn't be reported. We weren't sure exactly what to say about it because nothing had been officially brought up about it. So he's done for the year. But all those names raised eyebrows, and then you had 9 first-time starters on offense, defense. You throw in a new kicker in Alex Rayner. You had 12 guys make their debut. 20 guys that were either freshmen, redshirt freshmen, or walk-ons had to play Saturday. And for a lot of them, the lights looked awfully bright. Campbell was an experienced team. We talked about their defense having 5 fifth-year seniors. They had a really good quarterback. Their offensive line was huge. They played like a seasoned team because they had some experience about them. And maybe it took Georgia Southern two and a half quarters to get up to speed. But once they did, they started to dominate. Nearly 300 yards on the ground. Campbell was under 100 yards in the second half until that drive that nearly tied the game. And if they don't miss an extra point early on, they're going for the win instead of going for two to try to pick up a win. But going back to the inactives, this is how it's going to be this year. But if you think back to past years, let's look at a home game. Rosters have roughly 110, 120 guys now. Is that safe to say?
Sure.
Okay, you would say 80 to 90 guys on average suit up, give or take. So that means that at least 30 or 40 guys are inactive every home game. When you go on the road, you take 70 guys. That means 50 guys are inactive every single game. You don't hear about them because, I'm sorry, but just because a third, fourth, or scout team guy does not suit up, I don't mean to be this blunt about it. It's not news. It's not news. But because we're in an era now where we need to understand who is out, not necessarily why they're out, but a list needs to be put out about what individuals aren't playing. It can't be assumed why someone is out, whether it's academics, whether it's some other team-mandated deal, whether it's from getting COVID or being part of the contact tracing. You can't be that irresponsible about this. When it is announced by Coach Lunsford or a member of Athletic Communications, then it is the right of the public to know. But until then, it's nobody's business.
You look at what the inactive list, and I know that's a new term for college football, but it's the same thing in the NFL.
Correct.
Every NFL team, what is it, 90 minutes before?
90 minutes before you get an inactive list.
Every team has to turn in an active list. Now, the NFL is a little bit different. You have to do certain things with injury updates and injury reports, stuff like that.
You have to identify the injury. There's no covering it up. And there's also differentiations between physical and COVID-related conditions, but they're professionals.
Right. And so, at the end of the day, it's just like it has been in the NFL for years past, where you get an inactive list 90 minutes before. We got the inactive list 3 hours before. And so, I know that seeing 33 names on an inactive list that gets put out for college football is new, but let's also, this isn't going to be the first and only time. Throughout the entirety of the year, you're going to have this inactive list. Hopefully it has less than 33,
yes.
But there are times where it may have more than 33.
You'd like to hope.
And you look at what happened just 24 hours before that. Memphis has so many on their inactive list, they can't play. They don't learn that until Friday night. You could be tailgating at Allen E. Paulson Stadium Friday night and then realize this many number of people are on our inactive list. We don't have a game.
All it takes is for someone that maybe wasn't on the list or near the list to develop symptoms. Who else has it?
Right.
You immediately have to think, how much of the team is this going to affect? You could go into a situation where you're thinking you're good to go, and then you're not playing the game.
Right.
Those are the likely possibilities, hopefully not ones that'll happen, but you've got to be ready to deal with those.
And Coach Lunsford has said it, of the 33 on that list, very few of them were actually positive COVID cases.
Correct.
And so there's a lot that goes into it. We've touched on it so many times throughout the time that we've been on air in the last 48, 72 hours of it could be injuries. Trevor Vleem was on the list. Coach Lunsford comes out in his press conference on Monday saying that he is out for the season because of an ACL injury.
Yes.
He is one of the 33. Okay, so now you're down to 32 players. Not that it makes it that much better, but that's just kind of the mindset that you look at it with. It could be injury. It could be suspension. It could be violation of team rules. There are so many other things that it could be, but, and I realize it, I get it. We're in the COVID era. We're in the COVID age that somebody's out. It's just like if you're at work, somebody doesn't come into work one day, you probably start thinking they probably have COVID. You don't think, maybe they're taking a day off. Maybe they have a doctor's appointment. I get where the mindset is coming from. That's not to say it is warranted. That's not to say it is necessarily the right way to go about it. It's just a transition process of, like we mentioned, college football has not really had an active list. They've had it. It's just not necessarily been as public. Now you have to make it public when you have 33 players on it.
Yeah, because the situation that happens Saturday, it happens a lot more than people realize. They might hear about 2, 3, 4 injuries per week, standard. But again, those guys that are in jerseys and shorts on the sidelines, they're technically inactive. You just don't see them reported in an official way.
Yeah.
So this is a relatively normal occurrence about guys being out. But in this way we have to operate, at least for 2020, and hopefully it's only 2020, everybody that's out, you have to document it. You don't have to say why. You just have to document it by saying inactive. And it's up to them to say why.
And this isn't an exclusive thing for Georgia Southern. This is all across the college football world. You look at Arkansas State, that had somewhere upwards of 20, maybe a couple of more than 20, out for their game against Kansas State. They end up going and upsetting Kansas State.
Yeah.
But they had 20 guys. You think people in Jonesboro weren't freaking out too?
Of course.
Probably. I guarantee you the phone lines were lighting up for Kara Ritchie. But at the end of the day, it's like Coach Lunsford has said so many times since he took over this program. A, control what you can control. B, you get hit with adversity, you got to deal with it. It's as simple as that. You have to deal with it. Would they have liked to have Wesley Kennedy on Saturday? Absolutely.
A little bit.
Would you like to have CJ Wright this past Saturday? Absolutely. There are so many guys that if you had the choice, yeah, I'd probably take 33 out of 33 of them.
And are guys going to be back this week? Maybe. Probably. We don't know. Are more going to be out? Maybe. Probably. We don't know.
And that's the crazy thing about this year. We're sitting here on Tuesday, and the team doesn't test until later in the week. They don't get the results back until later in the week.
Correct.
And so Coach Lunsford has said it. You get the results back on Friday. You could have a full practice on Thursday, ready to game plan, ready to roll. You get the results back Friday.
Out, 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 out.
Yeah, you just start
out,
crossing out. People off the flip card.
Then what? That's a little bit of what this team was dealing with going into a game against an FCS school. Was Georgia Southern expected to win? Absolutely. Did they win? Yes.
Yeah.
They won the game. They had to stop a two-point play with 15 seconds left, and the ridiculousness of the onside kicks at the end, thankfully, the rule came in where you cannot block before 10 yards, even though Campbell had recovered the second onside kick. No blocking can take place inside that 10-yard window. They try to pooch kick on the final when it goes out of bounds, and Georgia Southern got the win. Harken back to 2015 when Georgia Southern got their doors blown off by West Virginia.
Yeah.
Eagles ended up winning 9 games.
Yeah.
2018 against South Carolina State. It was a fairly convincing win, but it didn't look dominant. Team wins 10 games.
Every time a Georgia Southern game doesn't go necessarily the way that everybody around the program expected it to, the one thing that I keep going back to is 2013. My first road trip was to Wofford. Georgia Southern gets beat by Wofford up at Gibbs Stadium, and we're leaving the stadium thinking, this may not be the best year. What happens that year? We beat Florida. So it's one game. I get it. I get the fandom.
Yes.
We've talked about it before. The passion of Georgia Southern is what makes this place special.
Of course.
But also, there are times where you might want to pump the brakes.
The biggest overreaction in college football is either overvaluing or undervaluing week one.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of people in Conway, in Lafayette, and Jonesboro that may think they're going to go into the college football playoff because the Big 12 may have just become a G5 league.
Yeah, it's the Cajuns versus the Red Wolves at this point.
And Texas Tech nearly lost a game to Houston Baptist. They were favored by 40 points. They had to stop a two-point conversion with 2.5 minutes left. Otherwise, they may have lost that game. So the Big 12 was almost in a whole nother heap. But yeah, those three made the league look great. Just because Georgia Southern didn't bludgeon Campbell, despite having 33 guys out, despite having 10 new starters, despite 20 freshmen and walk-ons having to play, they had to rally from two scores down halfway through the third quarter, score 21 straight, still won the game without having their whole crowd. In a way, you're also living in a town that's been deemed a hotbed for COVID by the federal government.
Yeah.
Small town, big school. It's amazing that the football team hasn't been affected more by it. And that's where the credit goes to the staff and the administration being as healthy as they were going into the game. So let's be mindful of that when this week's inactives come out. let's just not assume that everybody has been irresponsible and been affected by COVID. Let's have some sensibility and just hope whatever is going on, that it improves quickly.
Yeah. Again, I get it. I get the reaction of, uh-oh, this isn't going to be good. I get it. When we got told the names, our first reaction is probably the same. But then you have to kind of take a step back and think, okay, this team has gone through a heck of a lot more difficult than this.
Sure.
I mean, really, truly. And so, at the end of the day, it's one game. Now, if it goes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6
then
games,
we might have something to talk
then
about.
Then we can talk and have a different conversation.
And I think
but about, it's one game.
I think about all those guys that played. They were not brought here to be backups. They were brought here to play Georgia Southern football. Don't tell me because just because they're young they can't do it. They proved they can. Watching Tyler Bride, watching Derek Canteen, Javon Singletary, Khalil Crowder, a lot of guys who we don't see a whole lot of, they prove that they can play this game. And the more that they get experience, we just hope the better they're going to be and hopefully get to 2-0 this weekend against FAU.
27-26, Georgia Southern gets the victory over Campbell. Before we go too much farther, we talked about three onside kicks at the end of the game. Now, it was the first one, onside kick, but Georgia Southern had called the timeout.
And nobody could hear because of the
right.
buzzers.
Coach Lunsford talked to Russ after the game saying that they had shown a two-kicker look and he wanted to make sure the Hans team was prepared for it. Okay, take two. High chopper, it goes over Kinnerson. Campbell recovers, but go to the monitor, which I didn't think this was reviewable, but they did it. Go to the monitor, Campbell blocked illegally before the 10 yards. Do it again. Try three, Georgia Southern falls on it, everybody's happy. I was trying to think in the time that we were watching it, when was the last time that I saw three onside kicks? Now you know where I'm going.
I know where you're going, and I've got one too, but okay. I know where you're going.
I'm trying to think of when the last time I saw three onside kicks so close together, and it's not necessarily the same exact. When you and I were up in Atlanta, and Aaron Soka is not going to be a big fan of this.
Thanksgiving last year.
Thanksgiving. Falcons versus the Saints. You and I were up there with Westwood One. Youngway Koo with the Falcons has to come and try three onside kicks. Only two of them counted. But that's the only time I've seen three onside kicks.
Well, the fact
and it was he made one onside kick, Falcons recovered, goes down, scores, comes back, onside kick. There was an offsides or a false start, something I can't remember what exactly brought it back. He has to do it again, and they got it again.
They recovered all three that night, only got credit for two of them. And then just this past Sunday against the Seahawks, they recovered another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Koo has found a nice little niche for him in the NFL in terms of onside kicking. The one time I saw three onside kicks, I was at the Citadel in 2013, the game against Old Dominion in Norfolk. Old Dominion onside kicked three different times in the second half because they didn't want to have to deal with the flex bone that the Citadel was running, and the Citadel really couldn't stop. Old Dominion spread. It was a crazy game, 1,100 yards offense or whatever. But I'd never seen a team that wasn't down onside kick three different times.
Yeah.
And they got one of them.
One for three is not bad.
Old Dominion won that game 59-58. Citadel missed a two-point conversion with about a minute left.
Dang, there was a lot of cannons firing that day.
Yeah.
But we put the 27-26 victory for Georgia Southern over Campbell to bed. Look ahead to the Florida Atlantic Owls coming in under head coach Willie Taggart in his first season down in Boca Raton. We'll dive into them in our final segment of this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation. But for now, we step aside for some Eagle Tales.
Time now for Eagle Tales with Danny Reed and Roger Inman.
Roger, this is going to be a special moment on Saturday. It's the first time that Georgia Southern has had a home game on a Saturday on ESPN in 30 years. Thinking back to some of those early Georgia Southern games that were on TV, what was it like at Northern Iowa in 1985 when Larry Munson stepped down from Athens to call that one?
They probably searched around at the, you know, and asked, you know, Rick Mandy's still with us at that point in time. They probably asked around who's available, looked at Georgia's schedule, and they weren't playing, and somebody made a phone call to Larry, and Larry's going to be obviously glad to do it. It was a an excellent voice to have on that game. You know, he had a lot of things that he could say positive about Coach Russell since they were together for quite a few years in Athens. And to Bill Edwards. Bill Edwards was my first TV interview with WJCL over in the studios on Abercorn many, many, many years ago when he was doing sports for them and representing Russ. But, you know, I went back and watched part of that replay recently, listening to Larry and Bill on that game.
Wow, great stuff. Thanks, Roger. Now let's go to Colin Lacey with this week's Beyond the Bio.
Time now for Beyond the Bio with Colin Lacey.
As we continue on this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation, we step into Beyond the Bio with Georgia Southern women's basketball and the newest assistant coach, Deontay McChester. Deontay, appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Joining the staff here as an assistant coach and recruiting coordinator under head coach Anita Howard. But take us back kind of through the beginning. Talk about your upbringing from Flint, Michigan originally. What was it like kind of growing up, and when did you first get involved in basketball?
Well, honestly, you know, Flint, Michigan is a basketball town. You know, so it's something that brings our city together, brought the city together. I was a part of a storied high school program that produced a lot of pros, a lot of Division I college players in general. And so, you know, I didn't think I was going to be a coach. You know, honestly, I thought I was going to be a veterinarian until I found out about all the biology and the dissecting of animals and stuff like that. And so, you know, all of my coaches thought I had a good personality. I was able to lead, was able to bring people together, and thought I would be a good coach. And so, you know, with that journey started, you know, early. You know, I was able to coach AAU basketball at a young age while I was still in college and undergrad with the Flint Affiliation Program. And that was something that really started it. You know, I was able to coach a lot of young men at that time and, you know, be able to see them fulfill their dreams of going, you know, high school, making varsity, and then also going to the next level. I was like, well, maybe this is something I could be good at, you know. And so I went to, you know, college. You know, I played 3 years of college. I tore my ACL. And, you know, my undergrad coach at Cuca College, which is located in Cuca Park, New York, my coach at the time was like, hey, man, I think you would be a great coach. And I was like, you know, why everybody keeps saying that? What do you see in me? And he was just like, I mean, your teammates respect you. You're able to get the best out of people. You know, you're a good leader. People, you know, willing to follow you. You know, come be my assistant coach. You know, I said, really? He said, yeah, your last year, come be my assistant coach. You're not able to play. And, you know, we won't have student in front of it. We won't have student assistant. You will be my assistant coach. You will have scouts. You know, you won't recruit, but, you know, when recruits come on campus, you'll be the lead liaison and stuff like that. And I was like, wow. You know, and that year was like really the trial and error for me, because my teammates who I had just played with the year before are now calling me coach, you know. And so once I saw that was a successful thing, I was like, maybe this is something I really want to do, you know, moving forward. And from there, I went down to Guilford College to be with Coach Palumbo. We had a really good year my first year there. You know, I was head JV coach. And I was the assistant varsity coach. I mean, we had a really good year. I mean, we had Ben Strong, who was 6'11", 7 foot, Tyler Sanborn, 6 foot, 7 foot. You know, we got this at a Division III. And I think we finished the year 26-5, won the ODAC tournament. Then most of those young men that I coached on their team are now coaches, you know. So left there. The next year, went to be a director of basketball operations for Bobby Collins, who's now the head coach at Shaw University. So he just got that opportunity. So I'm really happy to see him back on the sideline as a head coach. And then I left there, went back to the NEAC, where Cuca College, and I went to be assistant for Matt Allen, a full-time assistant for Matt Allen at Cobleskill, who is now the head coach at Wilson College. And so I went there, and then I left, you know, Cobleskill because I had some family issues. So I went back home to Flint to regroup. And then just something happened. They had started a women's semi-pro league there, the Flint Lady Flames at the time. And the owner and the coach, you know, asked me, like, hey, man, we would love you to come join us on the staff while you're here. And I was like, you know, I'm trying to get myself together, get back financially. And I ended up joining the team. You know, that year we were probably at the bottom of the conference and end up upsetting the number one seed and getting a bid to the national tournament, you know. And so it was a great, great experience that first year. During that year, you know, I ended up getting promoted within the season to associate head coach. The next year, the general manager, the head coach, he stepped down and he bought the team. So he became the general manager and the owner. And then he promoted me up to head coach. And that was a great experience. Most of the young ladies that I coached there, was able to get pro contracts. So that was a good thing. We were able to put, the Flint Lady Monarchs on the map because they changed the name from Flint Lady Flames to Flint Lady Monarchs. And it helped my confidence. It helped my confidence that, here I am. At the time, I was only like 26, 27 leading young grown women, when they were following my lead. And so I was like, okay, this is something I want to do, long term. Then after that stint, the next stint, I went to Claflin University to be an assistant coach for Tiffany Tucker. And then the following year after that, I got promoted to head coach of Claflin. Was a great experience. We had some, played in a really tough conference, a really tough division. And so that experience, it was really good. It taught me a lot. It was some things that I had to learn to go through the process to get where I wanted to go. And so left there, got the call from Fort Valley State. They offered me the head job to be the head women's coach at Fort Valley State. But before I was announced that, Tennessee State called me. And head coach Jessica Kern, offered me a position to come be on her staff. And I think it was the right time, for me to go to, on the path that I wanted to be on. And she offered me a spot on her staff. And so I learned a lot there, was able to gain my, degree there. So I'm a proud Big Blue fan, proud alum of Tennessee State University. So I was able to get my master's. And then here we are, join the Ingle Nation, for one of the, I'm excited to be here, to be around one of the hottest coaches in the women's game. Coach Howard She's phenomenal, and I think she's special, and I think we share a lot of the same values, and so I'm really happy to be here to help her with her vision.
You talked about a couple of different transitional periods in your life of when you kind of realized that coaching was something that you wanted to do long term. What were some of the things that really kind of got in you into a passion of, this is exactly what I want to be doing?
Great question. Well, for me, yes, I want to win every game that's on my schedule. I want to recruit the biggest, the biggest 5-star, 4-star, even if they tell me no. That's just always been my mindset. Just been coming from Flint, just until somebody tell you no, you just keep pushing. But the biggest thing for me that kept me going is when you get those calls from those young men and those young ladies, and they call and say thank you, you helped me change my life. They sending me baby pictures, they invite me to their weddings, and the young ladies, who's gonna be great moms and great servant leaders, and say, coach, I didn't see it now, but thank you. So when you get those calls, it's bigger than that championship. Now, don't get me wrong, I want to cut down nets, but when you have some kids that you were able to make an impact on their life and change their life and shape their life to give them a chance, because you just want to give them the chance to be prepared in the world, that what moves me, of a young man called me right now, one of my former players, I'm still do it like I was his coach. Same thing with one of my former players. If they call me right now, if I can do it in my power to help them, I am. I don't think coaching is just those 4 years. I think coaching is a lifetime commitment.
You talk about you started your collegiate coaching career on the men's side. What was the biggest thing when you were transitioning to the women's side of basketball? What was the biggest transition that you had to make?
I didn't know nobody, and nobody didn't know who I was. The funny story was, when I had got named the interim head coach at Claflin, before I was named the head coach, I went to the Final Four thinking like, oh man, hey, I just got announced head coach, and everybody was the women's side looking like, who are you? They hit me with the Heisman Trophy back up, And so I had to basically find my niche in the women's game. I've always been a fan of the women's game, from the ABL, my godmom, Tanya Edwards, I followed her when she was a high school coach. And, I just always been a good fan. Dan Hughes is one of my mentors, was able to just watch him. And so the biggest thing for me was just transitioning to getting to know people on this side, how they think, how they operate, and once I was able to sit down and study these people and who they are, my mantra was, they didn't know me, so when I saw their face, I was going to make sure I know, hey, how you doing, know their name. And so that was my biggest adjustment. I think the game is still played the same, recruiting is still the same, the women's side is a little bit more fundamental, a little bit more skilled, the men play a little bit above the rim, a little bit more, they can rely on the athleticism. And so that was probably my biggest adjustment, man. I mean, I've always been a fan and love the women's game.
You talk about your time at Claflin and head coach there from 13 to 17, but you served as the chairman on the SAIC Women's Basketball Coaches Association from 14 to 17, was a member of the South Regional Advisory Committee for 2 years, NCAA South Regional Rep for the 2017 Division II Women's Basketball Championships. Being so active, not only at Claflin, but kind of in the basketball world as a whole, where did that come from and what made you really decide to do that?
Again, it goes back to, you know, when you just never know when people are watching. You know, going back to, you know, when I said my coaches and my mentors all said that I'll be a great coach, you know, I was asked to be on those committees. You know, I was asked to lead those committees and stuff like that. And, you know, my heart is always helping, you know, and if it was to be able to help the game, because the games gave a lot to me, you know, I will always want to be a part of something to help, you know. Being outside of that, man, leadership is just so important, you know. And at that time, you know, being on the SIAC committee, you know, I thought we were behind in a lot of things, you know. And I thought at that time we had some really good coaches in the SIAC. I mean, some really good coaches. And I just thought, you know, compared to some of the other Division II conferences in the league, we were not matching up or faring up well. And so, you know, being on those committees, we were able to learn a little bit about the regional ranking, how they look at us, how they view us, you know. So just be able to educate our coaches on that. Being a part of the Division II, the rep, you know, for the Division II women's, that was a tremendous honor. You know, I was really excited to be a part of that because I was able to see at the highest level, you know, in our region, the type of coaches, the type of teams that you needed to perform at that level. But even in that process, I was able to gain some really good friendships, really good relationships with some coaches in the Gulf South, some coaches in the Sunshine Conference, and also in the SIAC. You know, even the commissioner, you know, one of the former ADs at Eckerd is one of my really good friends now, you know, just from meeting, you know. So I think it's important. I definitely think, you know, we always want to make sure that the game is in good hands, the game is evolving, and I was just happy and very fortunate that they saw something in me to be a part of it.
You've talked about your mentors a couple of times throughout this interview. Who are some of those names that have really kind of instilled different concepts into you and you really look to for advice?
I got so many. You know, I have to give, you know, starting back with my roots, you know, I can never forget where I came from, you know, just in Flint, Michigan. One would be my middle school coach, Coach Pleasant. You know, he was a tough one. You know, it was really tough, but he was one of the ones who he brought it out of me as far as me being a really good coach. David Munnerlin, you know, he's a legend in Flint. He started the AAU program, Flint affiliation. And so he even allowed me to be a coach at a young age and trust me within his organization to be a coach. You know, so he was really one of my good mentors, you know, back then. Tanya Edwards, who I spoke of, my godmom, you know, who played at the University of Tennessee for Pat Summitt, you know, had a really, really, really good college career and pro career. You know, I think I actually just got named a high school head coach back in Flint, you know. So, and Dre Wynn, who was the one who offered me the position to become the head coach at the Flint for the semi-pro team. He's a passionate man about women's basketball. I mean, I call him the women's basketball encyclopedia. You know, anything I want to know about women's basketball, a player or whatever, we go back and forth about who is this, who's the greatest, and X, Y, and Z. And he's helped me a lot with my career. You know, what he has helped invest in far as pouring into me, man, it just, I don't really know what to say, you know. So for them, that would be my ground roots mentors. But far as in the game, you know, I would say definitely Von Reed at Syracuse, the associate head coach at Syracuse. He's been a person that I've just looked up to, you know, the way he carry himself, the way he invests in me. He's not, you know, he'll tell me when I'm wrong. You know, he'll tell me, like, this is how you want to look at it. You know, we talk a lot about us as African-American males being in the women game. Where do we fare up now? And so he's been a really good influence. Dan Hughes, who's the head coach at the Seattle Storm for the WNBA, allowed me to come to a couple of his preseason camps and to be able to see that because, you know, ultimately I would love to coach in the WNBA. James Wade was a part of that staff, who's now the head coach at Chicago Sky. And then, you know, like I said, I don't want to forget nobody, you know, because people are going to be listening. Like, you ain't give me a shout out. So it's really a lot of mentors. But far as those type of people right now, man, you know, Matt Allen, you know, Bobby Collins, you know, Coach Howard, you know, has been really good. Me and Coach Howard has been knowing each other almost a decade now. And Coach Howard has been really recruiting me and trying to me to come help her work and stuff like that. And so this opportunity, when she called and offered me the position, I was like, it's a no-brainer, Coach. I like what you're doing. I think you're special. I think you deserve a seat at the table. And I think, you know, with your mindset and my mindset and the staff that she's assembled, I think we have a chance to do some really good things.
What was that conversation like? You talk about you and Coach Howard going back almost a decade now, but what was that conversation like of when she's offering you the job to come to Georgia Southern? What's kind of been your first impression?
Well, that first conversation, you know, she needed something. You know, she felt like she had the pieces, and she felt like she was missing a piece to the puzzle. And you know, that piece of the puzzle was just somebody that had, I guess, had strong recruiting ties, was able to be able to build relationships, you know, to be able to you know, put a lot of confidence into the young ladies, and you know, also help her carry out her vision. So when she laid that out, you know, it was parallel with some of the things that I was trying to do and that I wanted to go, you know, where I'm trying to go and stuff like that. But you know, her record, it speaks for itself. Her ability to get to the highest level, you know, and get the best out of the young lady speaks for itself. And so I wanted to be a part of that. And so, you know I probably wasn't the number one choice, you know, far as, you know, resumes, you know, but I think when she called me and just say, hey, I think there's just something special in you, like, you know, we've been knowing each other 10 years. I've always recruited you to come be on my staff. And, you know, over the years, we've recruited some of the same players. You've got some players that I wonder, like, how he get that player. And so I was like, well, Coach, you know, if the opportunity presents itself, you know, this time, you know, I would love to come help you build, you know, and, you know, make your vision come true at Georgia Southern, because I think it's a special place. And I think, you know, with her vision, I think she's going to take this program to the next level.
Finally, before we let you go, this segment's called Beyond the Bio. Give us something that seeing you on a game day, seeing you around the office, people may not know, something beyond your bio.
Like I said, man, it's you know, I'm a chameleon, man. I like to be involved in a lot of things. I like to have fun. You know, everybody, you know, I meet comes in and say, man, you a ball of energy, man. Like, where you get that energy from, man? You know, I don't know. I just try to live life, you know, being optimistic, you know, being positive, and, you know, just trying to make an impact in the world, you know, because we're in a tough time right now, you know, just especially for just our country. You know, it's hard. And a lot of people out here are going through a lot of things that we just don't know. And so if I could be a light to somebody, if I could be a spark to somebody, if I could be a, you know, the changing factor of somebody like I was to those young men and young women, you know, that's me. You know, like I said, I just want to be a part of something special. But something things people may know, man, a black man from Flint, Michigan, I love horses. I love horses. You know, that's very weird. People are like, how you love horses? So my late stepfather used to take me to the racetrack with him. And, you know, while he was up there betting or whatever, I couldn't be up there with him and his friends while he was betting. So I would go out to the, you know, to the front, and, you know, I get a chance to pet the horses. I get a chance to feed. And I just became in love with them, you know, like, so I love cleaning horses, love washing them, and, you know, love riding them and stuff like that. And, you know, being from Flint, you know, you don't see too many horses. You don't see too many horses. But, you know, that's what I love. I love community service. You know, I love helping people beyond the game of basketball. I love helping young men. I think there's a lot to be said of young men needing mentorship, you know. So if I see a young man in the street and if I can help them, you know, just instead of beating them down and, you know, trying to be a positive inspire, you know, that's me. And then for me, you know, I'm really at some point I hope in this career that I'm able to give back to the city of Flint. You know, we're still in a tough time in Flint with the Flint water crisis. It hurts me to my heart that we still have, you know, it's almost been 8 years since something has happened, you know. And so there's people still being affected. My whole family still in Flint. And so I just want to make sure that me using the, you know, being a part of basketball opening so many doors, that not to get to where I came from, you know. So, but outside of that, man, I'm just a fun guy. You know, I just love to see other people win, other people get their blessings. And then, you know, one day, you know, God will bless me with mine.
Coach, appreciate the time. Can't wait to get it going with the women's hoops.
Yes. So everybody come out and check us out this year. We're going to be an exciting team. You know, this is a really, really talented bunch of young ladies that we have. We're excited to get it going. You know, we're hearing good news that we will have a summer. So all Eagle Nation out there, please go get your tickets. Call Coach Howard. Get on the season ticket list. Call us. Call, email. Whatever we need to do, we need to see y'all in Hanner Field House because it's going to be an exciting show to watch.
Once again, that is Deontay McChester, the new women's basketball assistant under head coach Anita Howard. Good to have some new hoops in because we've talked about Brian Berg and his staff, but the new name for Georgia Southern women's basketball, hadn't gotten to catch up with him yet, but finally getting to see him and hang out with him for a little bit. And you want to talk about, we see the energy Coach Howard brought last year to this program. She's got somebody that may be 1A for her as far as energy is concerned.
There is going to be some basketball news tomorrow because the Division I Council was supposed to vote on when this year starts. This is where major college football and major college basketball differ because the NCAA controls basketball and its postseason. They can dictate when games start. Now, there's been rumors that it could be somewhere between November 21st through the 25th, which would be a couple of weeks later than usual. There could be a reduced non-conference slate, but like we talked about a lot these last few weeks, this is a year of adjustments, so don't be surprised when things don't look quite normal, but just be happy if they look somewhat close to normal. Put that on a shirt.
You should. Talk to William over at Southern Exchange, see if he can get that on a shirt.
I got to remember what I said now.
We've got it on the archive.
All right.
We'll get it to him, put it on an Adidas shirt, and we're ready to rock and roll. So we look ahead to the Florida Atlantic Owls coming into Paulson Stadium on Saturday, 3:30 the kickoff on ESPN. Airtime will be 1:30 on the Georgia Southern Sports Network as Frank Russ, Terry, and myself will be out in the back of the tailgate lot getting things going with the new barricades around, the Bud Light barricades right around us.
Yeah, it felt like we were having a rock concert there on Saturday.
I know. Felt like we needed to fill it up with a mosh pit, but it was actually to keep people out.
No, I don't think
that wasn't going to work.
Yeah, Paula Deen was enough, wasn't it?
Yeah, you are not joking.
I wasn't even here for that.
The longest 20 minutes in radio history.
I've listened to that tailgate interview between.
We go and listen to it every offseason.
Well, that's becoming our part of the rotation we do. What it was football with Andy Griffith. I always watch the program. We listen to Paula Deen's interview with Frank on tailgate before Troy in 14.
Hey, y'all. It was on. Florida Atlantic coming into Paulson Stadium this weekend, and this will be the Owls' first game of the season on the schedule. They were supposed to open up against Minnesota. That didn't happen.
Mm-mm.
Then it was supposed to be Stony Brook this past weekend. That didn't happen.
Mm-mm.
And so it's us to open up the season for the Florida Atlantic Owls coming in from Conference USA. And let's just say until today, if you're listening to this on time on Tuesday, to give you a synopsis of what our week looks like, normally on Sunday, we're putting together our spotting boards that has everybody in the correct spots of where they're supposed to be. Until Tuesday, we have no idea. Because guess what? You've got new coach and head coach Willie Taggart, but you've also got a lot of new things as far as pieces for the offense, pieces for the defense, so nobody had any clue what was going
to
happen.
Where to begin with Florida Atlantic?
Because I think that's kind of what they were thinking, too.
I'm not going to be surprised if we don't see any kind of depth chart until maybe later today, maybe Wednesday. I don't even know, maybe Thursday. The spot that they're in, look, Lane Kiffin was their coach for the last 3 years. Two of those years, unreal. 11 wins, Conference USA championship. But after winning the Conference USA title last year, they dominated UAB. He takes the Ole Miss job. Doesn't take that many guys with him. But when Willie Taggart was announced as the new head coach 2 days later, that immediately set them on a new course. And then you throw in COVID-19. They didn't have one spring practice. That was a storyline for Campbell last week. And for FAU, they didn't start on-field activities until July, a month later than what Campbell had done this summer. And like Georgia Southern, FAU had a five-day shutdown because, as was reported in the Sentinel newspaper, they had three positive COVID tests. So while Georgia Southern is wading through its own uncertainty, you've got the fact that FAU, new coach, new coordinators, new schemes, eight starters gone on defense, standout quarterback gone, multiple wide receivers gone, two starting offensive linemen gone, two extremely valuable tight ends gone. We don't know because I don't think that they fully know.
No.
And that may play into Georgia Southern's hands because I think FAU is going to come into Paulson Stadium favored on Saturday. Which
yeah,
that's just how that is. They won 11 games last year. They won their bowl game that they hosted. They played in their own Boca Raton Bowl at FAU Stadium and crushed SMU. Can you imagine playing a bowl game in Allen E. Paulson?
You want to talk? Ryan Chambers said there's going to be a party that Saturday night. That'd be a whole new definition of a party.
Okay, let's start offensively because Willie Taggart is an offensive guy. He played quarterback at Western Kentucky and then was an assistant coach out there through the 2005 season. He was a staff assistant and the co-OC when Western Kentucky came down here in the 02 playoffs, and that team beat Georgia Southern in the semifinals. They won the national championship that year. The head coach of that Western Kentucky team, Jack Harbaugh, father of John and Jim Harbaugh. It was actually Jim Harbaugh that recruited Taggart to go to Western Kentucky while he was playing quarterback in the NFL for the Indianapolis Colts. He was an NCAA-sanctioned, non-paid volunteer assistant that helped his dad recruit the state of Florida. So that's how he was ushered into Bowling Green, Kentucky. He's one of only four guys that has his jersey retired for the Hilltoppers. And you know that I worked in Bowling Green for a summer in 2015. Every day I drove to work by Smith Stadium, his number one is posted on the wall outside on the way into Bowling Green ballpark.
So you've seen it a time or two.
So he's a dude. What Adrian Peterson is to Statesboro and Tracy Hamm is to Statesboro, Willie Taggart is to Bowling Green, Kentucky. He was an assistant coach for Jim Harbaugh out at Stanford for 3 years. He was the running backs coach, then went back to Western Kentucky as the head coach, and this is where it began. Three seasons there, twice he won seven games, but he had to break a 26-game losing streak in order to build that program. Then he went to South Florida, spent 4 years there, from two wins to four wins to eight wins to 10 wins. After that, spent 1 year out at Oregon. Granted, Oregon at the time was considered his dream job in 2017. He had a really good quarterback in Justin Herbert, won seven games, in fact, 7-5, and then leaves to come back east to go to his home state and be the head coach at Florida State.
I'd completely forgotten that he was the head coach at Oregon.
It gets lost
there
because he was there 1 year.
Yeah.
And that's the only place where he has a winning record. We'll get to that. But getting a chance to come back and be the head coach at Florida State, it didn't go well. 2018, 5-7, first time they missed a bowl game in 40 years. They started 4-5 last year. He was fired, got a huge, huge buyout because of his contract. And then middle of December, after Lane Kiffin goes to Ole Miss, he gets hired by FAU. Fifth different Division I school he's been the coach at. He's been the first African-American coach at all five schools, underscored by the fact that he has a losing record all time. He's 56-62 all time. That Oregon stop where he was 7-5, that's the only place where he has a winning record. It's known that his teams struggle at the beginning of his tenure. Now, 3-4 years down the line, I don't know that I'm going to want to see FAU. And Georgia Southern does go to Boca Raton in 2021 to FAU Stadium for the back end of this home and home. It's their first game. They've had not a lot of time on the field to get used to each other. There's a lot of new bodies. There's new systems. There's two OCs, Drew Maringer and Clint Trickett, who was on staff last year for Kiffin, but he was elevated from tight ends coach to co-OC. Taggart's going to call the plays. We'll talk about his offense more in a moment. Defense is Jim Levitz, D coordinator, remember the former head coach at South Florida. He coached South Florida when they came here to Paulson Stadium back in 98.
Of course.
Right. Spent 12 years there. At one point, they were the number two team in the BCS. Remember the BCS? Remember that a little bit? That 2007 season, he had them rolling. Ended up getting let go. He's been the defensive coordinator since at Colorado, and he was Taggart's defensive coordinator at Oregon that one season in 17. Both marked improvements. Analyst at Florida State last year in Taggart's second season. Tagger gets the job at FAU. He brings Levin on as defensive coordinator. So from the defensive standpoint, we know that Florida Atlantic is going to line up mostly in a 3-4 scheme. There's going to be some 4-man, but Levin is known as a 3-4 guy. And in this age of college football that is primarily geared around the RPO, he is dedicated to stopping the run. Number one on his list is stop the run. He does that by keeping his 7 guys close to, if not in the box. He wants to make sure that the zone read part is taken care of. So it puts a lot of stress on the secondary. And for a secondary that has 3 guys gone, the only starter back, Zion Gilbert, has moved from safety to corner. That could put some stress on them if the Eagles are able to mix in some pass with their run game. But there is just so much unknown with this team. I'm sure they're going to come in with a boatload of talent and try to threaten Georgia Southern's 25-game non-conference home winning streak. But I just don't think that they know what it's going to look like yet.
No, and we talked about it a little bit with Campbell that you don't necessarily know what you're going to get, but you had a lot of experience like we've talked about last week and in the first part of this week. With Florida Atlantic, there are so many new faces that you have no idea. You look at, they put out a spring depth chart. There are so many holes in that depth chart. It's not a depth chart.
And that's guys that they thought they would have back and guys that have either opted out because of COVID. Some guys have transferred. Miko Dotson, who was actually a backup corner last year for them, led the country with 9 interceptions. I'm going to repeat that. A backup corner had 9 interceptions last year. He transferred to Florida State. They lost both of their tight ends. Harrison Bryant had more than 1,000 yards receiving last year. First FBS tight end to go 1,000-plus since 2013. He won the Mackey Award as a G5 tight end. Nobody had ever done that before. Cleveland took him in the 4th round of the draft. His backup, John Rain, a really good one. I think he starts at 90% of the FBS schools if he doesn't go to Florida Atlantic. So this could have been his year there. He transfers to Northwestern. And now his year is up in the air. I know the Big Ten's still trying to figure out if they can play in the fall. But now he's mostly sitting on his hands up in Evanston, Illinois, wondering if not he's going to get a chance to play this season. They did announce a quarterback on Monday afternoon. Nick Trani is going to be the guy. That name may be slightly familiar. Georgia Southern played Indiana in 2017. Trani was on the roster, but he redshirted that year. He was in the mix at quarterback there. I don't think that the Eagles really expected him to play. But this is his offense to run. He won a 4-way quarterback competition. He's more of a running quarterback. Now, a year ago, FAU had a guy named Chris Robinson. Terrific. Cut out of the Johnny Manziel cloth. He threw for more than 3,700 yards. He set a school record, but he had some off-the-field issues. He was supposed to be back for his senior year. Not on the roster. He was let go during the summer. So that's why, new head coach, 4 quarterbacks. Okay, what direction are we going to go? Trotty played as the backup 11 games last year. He only threw it 22 times. He's a running quarterback. In fact, FAU used him a lot in their 4-minute offense. That's the one where, okay, we need to run clock. We need one first down to win a game. Now they're going to try to do that in a different scheme throughout the entire game.
I wonder, you mentioned it earlier, how Taggart in his first year or two has not been successful in stops that he has had previously. I wonder how much this plays to Taggart's favor. I know that's odd to say.
Yeah.
How much it plays to Taggart's favor not having so many guys that, because a lot of times when a new coach takes over, there's talent there that you can't not put on the field, if that makes any sense at all.
Sure.
There's guys there that you have to play. They may not fit into your system, but they are so talented, they are so athletic, that you have to play them until you get your guys in, quote-unquote. I wonder how much it plays into Taggart's favor that you don't necessarily have that luxury or problem, however you want to look at it.
I read a couple of articles on Taggart and how he had his turnaround at South Florida, because remember his last 2 years there of the 4, he won 8 games and then he won 10 games. He was part of an East Division championship in the AAC. He said things started to click whenever he stopped thinking. And coaching is a thinking man's game. But for Taggart, he saw all the weapons that he had. He simplified the offense, and he upped his tempo. He had so many guys that he could get involved, and he found that as long as he called plays fast and didn't overanalyze, he could get guys to do what they wanted to do, not necessarily what he wanted them to do. He just let them play. It, in a way that he phrased it, was backyard football. I mean, granted, there was a scheme and there were guys they had to block and places you had to be, but they opened things up and they simplified, and he let his athletes just play the game. And I think that that's what he's going to try to do with a cupboard at FAU, which, depending on where you're looking, may have a couple of cans. Some of them might have cobwebs on them with everybody that left. I know they'd love to have their two tight ends back, but he has a chance to, in one way, let them play, but number two, put his own stamp on this in his fifth try as a Division I head coach. And it could be a fascinating case study as soon as Saturday when they step on Paulson Stadium. Never played before. FAU was one of the best teams in the country last year on both sides. Defensively, they were number one in the country in turnovers forced and turnover margin. Georgia Southern was number one in 2018.
I've heard that story.
So there's a storyline in and of itself. But changing the coaches, maybe trying to keep things somewhat as close to the same as possible while adapting it to what each coach and what these players can do well relative to who's on the field at what time. This is one of the most unknown games I can ever recall doing here in any sport.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think if the Eagles, having already come back once and one game under their belt and having to rally from two scores down, they got so many guys' experience. They understand what it takes to win here, and they understand what it's like to play here where there is natural pressure and there is something on your shoulders. But you got to welcome that. You got to want that. And you got to be able to deliver that against FAU this weekend.
We will see that at 3:30, the kickoff from Allen E. Paulson Stadium on Saturday. And a lot of answers that we have, you will know when we know. Come Saturday afternoon, 3:30 to kick off here at Paulson, 1:30 the airtime on the Georgia Southern Sports Network. You have a look, and I know people can't see your look on the radio, but you know
that is the benefit, because we don't have the Facebook Live thing going. Yeah. how did you think the Friday night tailgate went last week?
I liked it.
I thought
it was something you and I have been talking about this. We've talked about it here and there over the last couple of years, but really started talking about it this year with us not being able to get out and talk to people as much as we normally do. But every Friday, or let me rephrase that, every night before a game, because
Friday, Wednesday, Tuesday
night, yeah, Maction. But every night before a game, at some point in the evening, and the times will vary a little bit,
yeah,
depending on the travel schedule, because traveling with teams is not necessarily the most, let's say, scheduled.
Well, you mean like next week, whenever the kickoff in Louisiana is 11 a.m. Central?
Yeah, trying to get Frank and Russ up for a 9 a.m. airtime, that's going to be fun.
They don't make alarm clocks that loud.
That's very true. But I thought the Friday night tailgate was fun. I was really surprised and extremely thankful for the number of questions that we got, because again, when you do things like that, you don't really know how it's going to go, especially the first time, because we didn't necessarily put it out until day of. And so not giving people a whole lot of fair warning, but had a lot of good questions, a lot of good conversation. Hopefully we answered all the questions.
Or got close.
We saw all the questions that we saw we answered, but...
And I think the benefit of this year is, at that point, we should have a firm grasp on what we're going to see the very next day. We do coaches shows on Mondays. We do the podcast for Tuesday. We do these as we find out information. But if you're listening to this on Friday, things could be drastically different. We visit with our coaches usually 2 days before the game. So, for instance, going into FAU this weekend, we will sit down with Chad Lunsford, Bob DeBest, Scott Sloan on Thursday morning. There could be multiple guys due to COVID, contact tracing, whatever, that don't get a chance to suit up, which could drastically change what they want to do offensively, defensively, and special teams. So the forum that we can develop on Fridays, on Wednesdays, on Tuesdays, to share as much as we can that we are able to, because if it's not official, then we can't disclose stuff or we can't talk about stuff. But at least we can peel the onion back enough to give you an idea of what we could possibly be dealing with.
We will do that again the night before every game day. So this Friday night, we have another Friday night tailgate on Facebook Live on the Georgia Southern Sports Network. But until Saturday, 3:30 the kickoff, 1:30 the airtime on the Georgia Southern Sports Network. For the voice of the Eagles, Danny Reed, this is Colin Lacey saying so long, everybody.
You've been listening to Inside Eagle Nation, powered by Learfield, the official podcast of Georgia Southern Athletics.